Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And now that New York and New Jersey seem to be breathing a collective sigh of relief, let's see where things stand in the investigation into the bombings, attempted bombings, and shootout with police of the last 3 days. And we'll take a step back and look at some of the issues that it all raises. I wasn't expecting the Daily News cover to be a mocking one today, but sure enough, it's a photo of Ahmad Rouhani wounded on his stretcher and the headline, Martyrdom, Bumbling Bomber Asleep in Barred Doorway. With me now are Daily News Police Beat reporter Rocco Perez-Gondola, John Jay College of Criminal Justice Police Science Professor Maria Maki Haberfeld, and Rick Ozzie Nelson, former director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Program, currently a non-resident senior associate at CSIS. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for coming on WNYC today.
Thanks for having us.
Rocco, what was the barred doorway scene? Rocco, you there? Oh. Okay, we don't have Rocco. Let's see if we can get Rocco up. Rocco, you there now?
I'm here.
Hi. What was that barred doorway scene?
Well, he had dozed off in the alleyway of a bar in Linden, and that's where police closed in on him, and that's where the shootout occurred.
I guess even accused terrorists have to sleep sometime.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like the first thing I thought of was you occasionally hear about suspects in major conventional crimes who, once they're taken into custody and put in the holding cell, they fall asleep. I don't know if it's because it's a big relief or because they've been involved in something where the adrenaline was sky high.
Maybe he had a sleepless night with pangs of conscience contemplating his acts of terror, or maybe he was just up too late putting shrapnel in 10 devices. And another subhead on page one says, fiend failed to detonate 8 out of 10 devices. Can you run down that list? There were 10 in total?
Well, there's the one on 23rd Street, which was successfully detonated, obviously. There's the one on 27th Street, which was not, quite possibly because two passersby who pulled the garbage bag holding the device out of a piece of luggage may have inadvertently disconnected the cell phone that was to be used as the detonator. So that's one out of two. There's the one in Seaside Heights that was not detonated. And then there were those in Elizabeth, New Jersey, which they believe he's responsible for, although not yet charged with.
Professor Haberfeld, this was such a bi-state terror and attempted terror spree from Seaside Park at the Jersey Shore through downtown Elizabeth and 23rd and 27th Streets in Manhattan. You know, there were areas, of course, north and east of there that weren't affected, but it was this, like, not an individual spot, but a metro region terror siege for the time that it was in effect and that people didn't know what was going on. What do you make of the pattern of targets?
Well, you know, to me, studying terrorism for quite a few decades, that's not necessarily a surprise, especially when we're talking about sort of a lone wolf approach. So lone wolves, even if they have a couple of associates, they do imitate and replicate events that happened in the past, and they create their own event or their own sort of map of how they want to go about this. So this particular individual is obviously influenced by the Boston bombers. He's also influenced by various ideas that are put out there by Inspire magazine and other publications by...
That's the ISIS publication, Inspire?
And, you know, there are other publications that are put out there by various terrorist organizations. So sort of, you know, I think every lone wolf creates his or her own playbook. And it's not necessarily something that we can understand in terms of rationale and common sense.
I heard speculation, Professor Haberfeld, about where Chelsea, the neighborhood of Chelsea, fit in, maybe because of its gay neighborhood reputation, like Orlando, that bar attack. But it's not so much over there, really, that a lot of gay people live, in front of the Section 8 housing for the blind and sort of the Flower District. Anything more specific on Chelsea as a target?
Just a random, location. It can be something that he considered as a dry run to see how the NYPD law enforcement and other law enforcement agencies respond, and maybe he had in mind something much more spectacular in the future, because obviously he's not a suicide bomber. He didn't stay there to be killed in the name of whatever cause he's acting on and upon. So it could have been a dry run that was easy to plan the bombs and the explosive devices, because you don't necessarily have a heavy law enforcement presence. This is a random street. But on the other hand, you also have to figure into this the premeditated notion of I can hit you anywhere. You're not safe on any street. You're not safe in any location. And this is sometimes more powerful than hitting a hard target.
Rocco, anything more on Chelsea as a target?
Yeah, sure. No, I agree with her, and I had a little more to add as well. That location, 23rd between 6th and 7th, is right near the PATH station. And while it's not entirely clear how he traveled to the city on Saturday, it's certainly possible that whenever he did come to New York, he used the PATH station, the PATH train, rather, got out of that station and just knew that area somewhat. So it might be as simple as that. It is an otherwise insignificant block. And to a larger point, yes, it is indeed more frightening to think that this could literally happen anywhere. And so the notion that, well, if I stay out of Times Square, or Grand Central Station, if I don't live in Lower Manhattan or in Washington, D.C., I'm safe, that increasingly is a feeling that no longer gives comfort. The Seaside Heights location might very well be, because there was a road race involving veterans, and he has spoken, at least according to his high school sweetheart, of a dislike for the American military. So that might explain that. But 23rd between 6th and 7th and 4 blocks north on 27th Street might just be an area he was familiar with that had no particular significance. And so the insignificance of those blocks might be what makes it significant, so to speak.
Listeners, as we debrief what appears to be the end of the terror threat for now, this particular one from this particular suspect anyway, and take some steps back and look at it in larger context, we invite your phone calls, questions, or thoughts, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. For Rocco Parascandola, New York Daily News, Police Bureau Chief, Maria Maki Haberfeld, Professor of Police Science at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and Rick Nelson from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Mr. Nelson, authorities say they are not actively looking for more suspects, and there is no sign of a terror cell. What would the clues be that would lead them to a conclusion that quickly that there's no terror cell that Rahami would have been a part of, perhaps?
Yeah, thank you. The first thing they would be looking for is any sort of communication, international cell phone calls, via email communications with any entities overseas. That's something that can be done very quickly, especially cell phone records. Computer forensics is a little bit slower, but not much. And if there were any communications overseas, that would be an indication that potentially he was talking and coordinating. And clearly, it looks like at this juncture, they haven't seen such evidence.
Professor Haberfeld, they set bail at $5 million, but they did set bail. Why is that? And do you see any chance he would be freed on bail?
Well, he's an American citizen, so as such, he's certainly entitled to, the same procedures and processes than any other citizen, no matter how strong we feel about this. So,
if somebody's a threat in any kind of a crime, a judge might say no bail because the person is too much of a threat to either flee or commit more crime, no?
But again, it's a tremendous amount of money, over $5 million, and the chances that he's going to be able to produce this amount, are practically zero. And I think that this is something that was motivating the judge.
Rick Nelson, are family members no longer suspect, as far as you understand? There was that stop of a car on the Brooklyn side of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge of some of Rahami's relatives. Is it your understanding that they're exonerated?
Well, I think it's too early to tell. Again, you know, one thing they're going to look at is not only its immediate family, but their extended family. He certainly has contacts overseas in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And so it is going to take some, you know, basic police sleuthing here to run all these contacts down and make sure that they weren't witting or, you know, seeing this happening and allowing it to happen. And sometimes that's a fine line, you know, when you see someone who may be exhibiting suspicious behavior and activities, you know, and you're a family member, do you turn them in? And if you so, when do you do that? And so it's going to be really, I think, difficult and probably take a couple more days, if not weeks, for the police to determine what level of involvement knowing this family had.
The first charges filed yesterday were attempted murder of a law enforcement officer and weapons possession. Here is U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara at yesterday afternoon's news conference.
We are not rushing against each other to bring charges. We have been all racing together to try to catch the perpetrator here, and that's now been done. But we're going to take a lot of care and a lot of time to make sure that if we bring charges federally in the Manhattan District Court, that we do it in a way that's careful and thorough.
Professor Haberfeld, what's Preet Bharara referring to there? What's the range of criminal charges and different jurisdictions that could bring them?
Well, you know, again, depending on where he's going to be ultimately put on trial, you know, well, it can be in New Jersey, it can be in New York, because you're talking about two different crime scenes. You have one in New Jersey, one in New York. Different, again, outcomes. In New Jersey, you have the explosions, but you also, which didn't generate any victims, but then you have the shootouts with the cops, which, and again, this is very serious when you engage in exchange of fire with law enforcement. In New York, you have people who were slightly injured, so you don't have fatalities. So we're talking about a broad range of charges in two different states and, again, two different jurisdictions.
Rocco, how are the officers involved in the shootout in Linden? Do you have a report?
Nothing updated as of today. I mean, the one who was shot, that was shot and wounded, not critically wounded, he will survive. Other officers who were wounded far less seriously hurt, and they will survive. Probably more shocked than anything else. I mean, the first World Trade Center bombing obviously had serious links to Jersey City, but Linden, New Jersey, Elizabeth, New Jersey, these are not towns or cities that prior to this past weekend we've associated with any sort of radicalization.
Mr. Nelson, Rahami has no previous criminal history, apparently. And apparently, as he went back and forth to Afghanistan a number of times, including for at least one extended stay, he was subject to secondary screening at the airport multiple times. But they never concluded that he was a suspect or put him on a terror watch list. Was this a failure of intelligence, in your opinion, or maybe was it a sign of good law enforcement work because he wasn't radicalized or involved in any terrorism until he was?
This is what makes this concept of lone wolf terrorism so difficult for the law enforcement agencies, because basically what they're required to do is to get in the head of the potential perpetrator to determine when they're actually going to move past, you know, rhetoric or past some disenfranchisement to violent action. You know, the law enforcement entities, they interview thousands of people like this on a regular basis, and to really, you know, cull down the suspects into people they can actually commit resources to is a very, very difficult task. And at the end of the day, it's almost impossible for the law enforcement agencies to determine which one of these individuals is actually going to go ahead and commit an act of violence. So I think it's a bit of a stretch to call it a failure of law enforcement intelligence. I think what they'll have to do is review the case, and they certainly will do this, and they'll see if there are any other indicators that potentially that they missed. And if they did find some, they will use those for future cases. But again, it's an extraordinarily difficult challenge for law enforcement to have to weed out those individuals out of thousands of potential suspects potential perpetrators, but who actually might commit that crime.
Zoe in Monroe, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Zoe.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Okay.
All right. So I wanted to make a comment. It's, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. I'm Muslim, and, you know, I've been here pretty much all my life. And I know a lot of people in the community. I know people from the high school that the bomber was from. And
Edison High.
Yes, Edison High, yep. And this is not something that I've ever seen, any sort of radicalization, anything like that. Like, so, you know, and my wife, who's from the UK, you know, she, and over there, it's a totally different story. Over there, you can see people becoming, you know, going in that direction. And that's like a thing that they, that even their social services, they look for. So, so any community, because they have a lot of Muslim communities that have that problem. But here, I've never seen it before. So it was very shocking to me to find out about this and, you know, see that there's somebody who's capable of, you know, doing something like that. So
are you concerned? Do you bring this up partly because you're concerned that Edison High and the Edison community in general, a lot of South Asians from various countries around there might get stigmatized unfairly by this?
Partly, yeah, you know, but I feel like that's been happening regardless, even regardless of whether it happened here before or not. But because you know, generally, you know, New Jersey is very diverse, New York, New Jersey, so that's not much of a concern for mm-hmm. me. But my main thing is, what I'd like to know is you know, I want to hear this guy out. I want to see if media can interview him and see what he has to say as to why, what his motives were. Because if you think about it, any of these attacks that have happened, we've never really heard from these people. We've never heard what they have to say or what, if anything, you know. If you think of even the Tsarnaev brother that survived, I don't recall them ever having any sort of interview or anything from him, right? Everybody else, they were killed, well, usually, you know.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And Rocco, the first reports I saw yesterday, and Zoe, thanks for your call, were that Rahami was not cooperating with police, so he wasn't giving them details. He wasn't talking about motive. I realize he was just shot, and it's the first day. But what do you know about that?
That is correct. However, you know, the following question was asked yesterday, and that was: is it a good thing that he's alive? And the answer back from law enforcement, from the head of the FBI office in New York, was absolutely, because now they can theoretically get information from him. He's not talking today, but he may be talking tomorrow. We'll learn more from him about others he might be working with. And then ultimately, even if he doesn't talk, they might be able to glean enough from social media, from his phone, from his computer, to get an idea what his motivation was. Obviously, if he talks, then that's the Holy Grail. That provides a greater window into motive. And in theory, that's something law enforcement can use, whether it's to prosecute others or to learn enough from this that in the future they tweak their approach to how they investigate terrorism and maybe make things a little bit safer.
And Mr. Nelson from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, some of the biographical information, I see he went to Edison High School and started but didn't finish at Middlesex County College. His family owned the restaurant First American Fried Chicken in Elizabeth, also known as the Chicken Shack, which Rahami lived above. He was born in Afghanistan but is a naturalized U.S. citizen, 28 years old. What's known so far, or what can you glean about what might have begun to radicalize him?
You know, it's really difficult to tell in these situations. You know, the caller is spot on. You know, in Europe and England and some of the other nations there, you know, their Muslim communities are marginalized and in large part are often in kind of a ghetto-like environment, which really leads to a sense of disenfranchisement that leads to this type of violence. That's not true in the U.S. The U.S., all of our ethnic communities are very well integrated and everyone has equal opportunity here. So this trend is very troubling. And what happens is you get individuals are disenfranchised for whatever reason. It may be because this individual felt he was being persecuted against, and his family business was being persecuted. Whatever the case may be, these organizations like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they do actually a pretty brilliant job of manipulating and utilizing these individuals and getting them to commit acts of violence. So at this juncture, we don't know what caused him to cross that line to commit this violent act, but with these individuals, there's usually some sense of disenfranchisement, some sense of humiliation that causes them to act.
And is there even the evidence, Professor Haberfeld, excuse me, to say that he was radicalized, that these were in fact political acts as opposed to coming from some other personal or psychological grievance or being off?
You know, a famous psychiatrist by the name of Hacker over 40 years ago identified three categories of terrorists, the three C's as we refer to them, crazy, crusaders, and criminals. So the crazies are individuals who, feel some sort of grievance against the larger society and decide to, to take vengeance based on the perceived grievances. The crusaders are the ones who we would refer to as the radicalized. They believe in some sort of primarily religiously based holy ideas that motivate them. And then the criminals are doing this just because, they enjoy being engaged in criminal activities. So in terms of evidence, we can only speculate based on the fact that he referred to the Boston bombers. And this, to me, is as close as we can get in terms of him falling into the category of crusaders, because the Tsarnaev brothers obviously did this for a cause, and they were radicalized. So if he identifies with them, this is as close as we can speculate right now.
In what context did he refer to the Boston Marathon bombers?
I believe that this was in one of the notes that was found.
Rocco, do you know more about that?
No, that's still something that's being fleshed out. So that's not entirely clear. Yesterday, authorities were saying they didn't have any evidence yet of why he radicalized or when. Talking to his neighbors, you get a sense that upon returning from overseas, he was a changed man. And he was overseas several times over the last 10 years, both his native Afghanistan as well as Pakistan. And I think one neighbor in particular, a man who described himself as a pretty close friend of his, said that he was more serious, he was quieter, and he was religious. And generally speaking, someone who finds religion isn't necessarily someone who's going to get radicalized. And this particular friend didn't see that. He just saw a man who had found religion and was pursuing that, not someone who found religion and wanted to act out on it against America. So it's a very fine line. The fact that the race in Seaside Heights involved members of the military, that perhaps could provide some insight. He talked, as I said earlier, he had talked to his ex-girlfriend about not liking the U.S. military. So those are all little nuggets of information, little possible signs, but nothing is really clear-cut yet. It may not be for a while.
And Professor Haberfeld, another related issue was de Blasio and Cuomo early on disagreeing about when to use the word terrorism. On Sunday, they agreed that there were intentional bombings, but no known political motivation at that time. And even now, it's being ascertained. But certainly on Sunday, they had no idea about what the motivations were. And de Blasio said that meant they couldn't call it terrorism. But Cuomo went right for that word, even while saying he had no idea whether it was politically motivated. Who was right?
Well, I have my own definition of terrorism because there are so many definitions. So anybody at any given time can be right, quoting one definition or the other. And my definition is about various have-nots against the have. And the have-nots, in my definition, are individuals who feel certain grievances. It can be a personal grievance. It can be grievance based on religious or political beliefs. And this is an individual, a small group of individuals who terrorized the larger groups of individuals. So, yes, we were terrorized on Saturday. And we were terrorized with the explosions in Chelsea, and we were could have been terrorized through the explosions that didn't happen in Seaside. So, to me, it's very clear. It was absolutely a terrorist act, and the motivation is a different story.
But I would say that it's not always have-nots against the haves. There's such a thing as state terrorism, where the powerful are terrorizing the powerless. And do you disagree at all, Rick Nelson? Do we need to stick to a certain definitional standard so that there needs to be a political motivation behind a series of attacks or an individual attack? Otherwise, to call it that is just pandering to fear, maybe even pandering to bias?
I think you're onto something there. I mean, again, the definition of terrorism is one of the most argued and debated terms, at least during my time in government. And it's important to note what we have here. But at the same time, you're right. We don't want to, instill fear in individuals. Where it really comes down to, terrorism is really in the law enforcement and the prosecution. You know, prosecuting someone for an act of terrorism is a much difficult idea than prosecuting someone for murder. So immediately, the political argument begins that we're not calling this guy a terrorism because we're prosecuting him for murder or attempted murder. But attempted murder charge is a lot easier to make than a terrorism charge because of what you point out. You have to prove the political motivation. It's a lot more subjective than a purely objective thing, something like attempted murder. So again, I think it's more political debate and posturing whether this is terrorism or not. I would call it terrorism, but at the end of the day, what we have here is these individuals that are being motivated to conduct these types of violent acts that are unsettling to society and disrupting society, and that's troubling.
Diane and Lyndon, you're on WNYC. Hello, Diane.
Hello, how are you?
Okay.
I'm glad to be able to get on. I do live in Lyndon. My goddaughter works four doors away from where the suspect was apprehended. I'm very grateful that the police department and the Homeland Security or whatever and the detectives worked together and didn't kill the guy. I think it's very difficult for a cop to be shot at and not shoot to kill. So I'm very grateful to my town's police department for bringing him in alive.
Diane, thank you very much. And I know we had a terrible connection there. For those of you who couldn't understand Diane in Lyndon, she's grateful to her police department for having the restraint to not shoot to kill Mr. Ahami and bringing him in alive. But, Rocco, do police actually do that for you as an experienced police beat reporter for the Daily News? I think I've heard from police over the years there's no such thing as shoot to wound because you can't cut it that fine and protect your life.
No, that's correct. They are trained to shoot to kill. I mean, I'm sure there are a handful of incidents through the years where a police officer clearly felt he had a clear view of the man's leg, let's say, and shot his leg. But by and large, and I would put that at less than 1/100 of 1% of the incidents, police are trained to shoot the center mass, are trained to shoot to kill. And in that moment, I'm sure that Linda police officer was thinking just that. It's not easy to shoot and kill. It's not even easy to shoot and hit. Most officers, when they do fire, typically only 20 to 25% of the shots actually strike the intended target. You often have people moving, sometimes both people, officer and suspect. The adrenaline is flowing. There may be obstacles in the way. And so given all that, if you want to factor into that the notion that you should shoot to wound, it would make the hit rate even less. So they are indeed trained to shoot to kill. And in this case, it didn't happen, and that might benefit the investigation in the long run. But that's just a stroke of luck, I would think.
I want to touch one other issue before you all go. One issue that's come up is of the de Blasio administration's use of the emergency alert system, where it seemed like everyone in the city's cell phones went off at the same time yesterday when they put out that wanted alert. Here's Mayor de Blasio defending that act.
There was a way to reach people different from the past. No more a wanted poster, on the precinct house wall. This is a modern approach that really engaged the whole community.
Rocco, why is that controversial? Who's criticizing that?
Well, the controversy with it, it hasn't been fully explained how that actually helped in the capture. We don't know if the men who saw him initially in the alleyway noticed knew of his face from that alert, or perhaps from watching it on TV or on a newspaper website. Additionally, the alert does not, at least at this point, allow for the transmission of photos. And so the alert said something to the effect, see media for PIC, P-I-C, short for picture. And so if you got that alert, and I did, and everyone else in the city did, who has a cell phone, I guess, and you wanted to see what the man looked like, you went scrambling on a different app or on your laptop or on your cell phone for a photo. I had already seen his picture because it had already been tweeted out by the NYPD. So it's just not entirely clear how it came to help. I mean, in theory, if it had played out a different way, if a man with that name and that credit card made a purchase somewhere, that cashier might have realized, hey, this could be the guy. But as it played out, it's still not entirely clear if those who initially saw him knew that was him from that particular alert.
But Professor Haberfeld, in terms of your knowledge of police science and this as a tool, whether or not it wound up helping in identifying and capturing the suspect, is this unprecedented in any way, or how do you understand why it would be controversial?
It's not unprecedented because, you know, we first of all, we have the system intended to notify people of various emergencies. For example, it's been used in Amber Alert when a child is kidnapped. So the criticality of this in Amber Alert is we want to apprehend the kidnappers as soon as possible because of the lives of the children endangered. And same thing here. We didn't know if this individual is not planting another bomb on another corner someplace else. So in that sense, alertness, from my perspective, you cannot be too alert. And you can always criticize any innovation because, relatively speaking, it's new because it was used for the first time for this particular type of criminality, terrorism. But I am very much for this, and I think that we do need to increase our awareness on all possible venues, all possible platforms.
So this even became a thing on The Daily Show last night. Here's a little bit of Trevor Noah on the emergency alert system.
Not only were New Yorkers not affected by the bomb, New Yorkers were genuinely annoyed by having to deal with the bombing. I've never seen anything like this because early this morning, right, the city of New York sent an emergency alert to everyone's phone to be on the lookout for a particular suspect. And New Yorkers...
And he goes on from there to say at least one thing we can't repeat on the radio, though they can say it on cable television. I don't even know. Do we sign up to be on an alert list, or are we all automatically enrolled, Professor Haberfeld? Do you know?
I don't think that we have to sign. We can sign up with various institutions, like I'm part of CUNY, City University of New York, so I sign up for various alerts, so this might be part of it. I think that most of the people are just automatically included in this in New York, because I've really seen it around me when it happened, like it almost happened to everybody who was around me with a cell phone.
Yeah, that's funny, because my old phone, I just recently changed phones after a number of years, and my old phone would get them all the time on weather alerts and Amber alerts, and my new phone did not get one yesterday, even though I heard them going off in the background with somebody I was on the phone with as they were in a public place. So we thank all three of you for joining us today. Maria Maki Haberfeld, Professor of Police Science at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Rocco Perez-Candola, Daily News Police Bureau Chief and author of Guns and God, The Life of an NYPD Undercover, his recent book, and Rick Nelson, former director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Program, currently a non-resident senior associate there. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up next, prosecutor says Christy knew. Do they have the proof? Andrea Bernstein and Matt Katz will try to answer that question. Stay with us.